Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, I get a lot of comments from those who, you know, I guess they're former Q followers, they're former, the military's taken over type of stuff. And I hate to tell you folks, the only way we're getting out of this mess, because there's the military can't do it, Trump can't do it, Obama did it, and look what he did. And so the only way we're getting out of this mess is when, whether we do it or not, because they're pulling the trigger. And regardless of all the misinformation that's out there, this is not going to just go away because good people are out there. You're the good people. You have to do this. And so it's now or never. And with that, the debt is fraud. I could go into details with that, but we've got too much content to cover for the rest of the year. And I should say that, you know, we need to invoke everything. You know, I'm not going to ever go down the, you know, the path of rubbing roots and throwing bones, but I will invoke the power of prayer. And so I would call upon anybody that believes in the power of prayer. You know, I believe that faith, the faith of a mustard seed, can move mountains. So with that, we've got Tammy back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And so thank you for your patience and me getting through that little diatribe. But Obama did it. So anyway, we left off. We're still going through the Bill of Rights. And we left off and we were talking about excessive fines and, you know, and cruel punishments and all of that. And technically, now that I think of it, we kind of dove into that. And as far as I'm concerned, we need to revisit this because I think we've been played, because everybody thinks that, oh, well, these flat rate fines and fees, you know, when it comes to bail, there's a lot of arbitrary, you know, dollars out there. But 9 times out of 10, many states kind of stipulate the same amount and so forth. And as far as I'm concerned, when you have the inequities that they have in the process, the fines, fees, penalties, and so forth, I've just got a problem with it. It's not a just system. When they can come after people, you know, and create a level of pain that decimates some people that are just trying to get by. I mean, I remember when I was young and I made some mistakes. And, you know, fortunately, you know, I wasn't decimated, but I was in a position where I could have been. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, you know. And so I wasn't a rock star. I wasn't some baseball, you know, partying kid or anything. Anyway, so remember covering this, and I think what we actually did was we just dove into the enumerations in the Constitution, which is the Ninth Amendment. Now, the Ninth Amendment is kind of like the sleeper amendment because it's the catch-all. And so let's go ahead and read this one.
Okay, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Yeah, there.
Okay.
I have my own notes. I almost read my own notes.
Right. Okay. So, and it would have been funny if it would have been, you know, really excoriating someone. Anyway. Okay, so enumeration, by the way, you know, most people may not know what that means, but that means the listing or the, you know, the accounting. And so the listing or the accounting in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So in other words, if all of a sudden they think, well, you know, here in the Constitution, we can do this to you. Well, not if it is a right that's retained by the people. I'll give you one. Do you have a right of commerce? Well, let me ask you this. Is there anything in the Constitution that gives the federal government the ability to regulate your commerce, the commerce of the people within the states? Not at all.
No.
So one can look at that and say, hey, you know, the federal government can't do that. But what about the state? Because the states do actually regulate commerce. It's one of the things they do. Mm-hmm. I mean, they allow businesses to get set up and so forth. Can they shut down your commerce? Can they take away your ability to make money?
No.
Because it's one thing to regulate the standards of business, but it's another thing to say you cannot operate without cause. In other words, okay, you killed a few people with the poison food you fed them, and you knew what you were doing, so we got to close you down. Right? I mean, that makes sense. Or actually, you're going to jail, so that'll close you down.
Right.
But can they get away with shutting you down because a whole bunch of people have sniffly noses?
Well, they did.
They did. Absolutely, they did. But do they have that right? Well, it's a state. The Bill of Rights is only speaking to Congress. Right? So remember, mm-hmm. We forgot about this, but I'm going to go back up to the preamble of the Bill of Rights. The convention of a number of states having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its power, of the federal government's power, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. So these clauses in the Bill of Rights were really being added to prevent the federal government from taking these actions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at the Bill of Rights, and the Ninth Amendment is a part of that, does this apply to the states? Or does this apply to those same constraints upon the states?
Well, no, you just said it applied to Congress.
Ah, you have not been listening to me enough.
Oh.
Okay, so we're going to just take a quick mosey down to the 14th Amendment, because this is probably where we want to start introducing it, because we're probably going to dive into this in the next, you know, couple days, or within the same day here. So what does the 14th Amendment say?
Oh, I would have to pull it up.
Okay. Go down there, and we're going to read in section one, because this is where we want to talk about it, right? So we're going to bypass the very first sentence. Tell me when you're there, because, you know, the suspense is killing everybody. And folks, drive responsibly if you're driving at this point in time. So we don't want you swinging off the road because, you know, you're trying to help her find it. It's the 14th Amendment, and it's interesting that they mentioned that this was ratified under duress. There was no duress at all. No duress. That is hyperbole that was labeled out by the progressives and the conservatives that have been co-opted. Because the only people that would look at the 14th Amendment because it is the one thing that the divine hand of providence basically couldn't get the framers to, you know, they couldn't see this and the need for this. But anyway, because when we go through the Bill of Rights, and hopefully we'll have time to dive into this, just to be clear, folks, Madison, during the debates in the very beginning, before they even initiated the Bill of Rights, before he could get them to do this, you know, there were comments from all the representatives from the states saying, oh, we don't need it. The states, they have their own Bill of Rights. And Madison actually started listening to the fact that, you know, this state doesn't and this state doesn't. And come to find out, there's only like one or two that actually had a Bill of Rights. And then in some of the states, he points out, you know, and oh, by the way, in these couple of states, you don't even have a right to bear arms. So Anyway, are you there? You got it?
I am.
Okay, yep. So we're going to start off with, and we're only going to read to the semicolon, which ends with the United States, but it says, no state shall. So we want to start with no state shall, and then we're going to read and then stop when we hit the United States. So go ahead.
Oh, you want me to start with no state shall?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall
no,
any
state...
No, no,
no, just stop right there because of the United States. You did it perfectly, right there at the semicolon. So this is called the Privileges and Immunities Clause. So going back up to the Bill of Rights, is that only applied to the federal government?
No.
Nah, because the 14th Amendment changed everything. It actually protected the people from bad behavior by the states. Why? Because the states were always the problem. The states were always the problem. And then when the states started actually working with the federal government and basically furthering slavery and all these other things, we actually had a moment of clarity. And that moment of clarity came from under the label and under the guises and the hyperbole of the progressives and the co-opted conservatives, the radical Republicans who gave us the 14th Amendment. How dare they save black lives? How dare they try to create civility in the United States to protect everybody and their stupid privileges and immunities? I'm sorry. I'm being really sarcastic because when you hear people say disparaging things about the 14th Amendment, I'm going, do you realize what you're saying? Now, who does it protect? It tells you right here the only people that have these protections are who? Privileges and immunities of?
Us.
Citizens,
we the people, yeah.
Citizen, it's very specific. Citizens of the United States. So if you go down the path of, you know, opting out and become a sovereign citizen and say, I'm not a citizen of the United States anymore, what did you just lose?
A lot of protection and freedom.
All the protection under the Constitution. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's almost like swearing off being a child of God. Now that, you know, in this world and in this life, surrendering your privileges and immunities may not seem like this big impact. It's not like you walk out, next thing you know, people are taking your property and everything else because you're no longer a citizen. You know, that's not happening to them. Right now, it just seems like, hey, nothing's happening. These people are getting away with it. Which, you know, what happens when things like that are perceived, it actually seems like a real good idea. Well, I'm going to go do that. These people don't have to pay taxes. You know, I'm going to do this. Now, let's work through this, you know, the deception here. If the progressives succeed, who are the first people that they can get rid of? The people that have no say. The people that aren't citizens. People that have no claim or right under the Constitution, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? And so, you know, do you think it's a brilliant plan for the progressives to actually tell cops, well, okay, pull them over and just let them go? Because people are going to see that and they go, wow, this works. Look at that. It works.
Mm.
How stupid are these people? I'm sorry. You know what? I do know that there are people, and I have had conversations, and I'm friends with some people. But the people that just, they want to go down this path because they don't want to pay taxes, that is a big foolhardy jump. Now, I've known good people that were forced down this path because they were literally being crushed and destroyed. They've lost their families. They were losing their property and everything else. And the only thing that stopped them was they basically bailed out.
Hmm.
And they said, you know, I'm done. I'm no longer a citizen. And they bought out their property where they took title for it and everything else. And they basically said, go and leave me alone.
Yeah.
So there are people out there that are pushed to that point. But those people that are only doing it just so they can make that little extra money, because believe it or not, do you think having a decent road system, and do you think having the government, we're not supposed to have, but it is, and it needs to shift back to where it needs to be, where it needs to, you know, belong at the state level. As a matter of fact, I talked to people. I was speaking to a person that's, I'll just say, in the bureaucracy in D.C., and there were a lot of people in this organization. These were patriots, by the way, and they, you know, were, you know, hey, GR, he wants to do really bad things because he's going to take our job. He's the big unemployer. We're going to become unemployed because of that guy. And then the guy points this out. He says, hey, you know, I'm getting all these people saying, you know, they're going to lose their jobs over at the Department of Transportation. And I said, hold on here. Do you really believe that if the Department of Transportation goes away, that the people of the states are going to stop driving and using railroads and flying around? Well, no.
Yeah, definitely no.
And I said, so what's going to end up happening is the states, whatever the federal government has been doing, and then, you know, there's going to be a lot of excess, right? There's the bureaucracy and the waste of money that is just inherent within the federal government and within government, period. But I mean, it's on steroids at the federal government level. So, okay, so this is going to come back to the states, and they'll probably do it more efficiently. And so do you think those people will have jobs? Yeah, they'll have jobs. It just won't have the, you know, they won't live in the elite communities of D.C. Sorry. But you'll still have jobs. There'll still be an opportunity. You may not have that same retirement. That'll all go away. But who has a right to a retirement that's not actually legitimate? Right? I mean, when you realize you've created a system and you know, I hate to say this, but every party needs to make sure, and I can understand when you walk into a federal job and you go, wow, this is a permanent, this is a good thing. And you realize that all of a sudden, you know, the reality hits the bearer of bad news, you know, knocks on your door or comes into your workplace, like the states, and says, sorry, you don't have the authority to be operating this power, role, and responsibility. Sorry. Now, my advice, if you've ever read my first book, I lay it out there that we don't want, actually, I think it was maybe the second book. It was in one of my first or second book. That I said, the last thing we want to do is actually turn the lights off and throw everybody out in one day.
Mm-hmm.
What you want to do is you want to do this over a 6-month to a 1-year period so that, you know, nobody loses their job within the first month or two. It allows people to start, you know, saying, okay, my cheese has moved. Where do I want to end and land? You know, I want to go all the way to California. There's going to be a lot of people that are going to, it's a bad metaphor, but that's what you call them. It's the people that are jumping off ship because the ship is sinking, right? And so those people try to swim to the closest shore. And so that may have been where that ship really was. And it's not, I'm going to tell you, the further you swim, possibly the better off you'll be.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So those people that you're really smart because, yeah, you may land in Virginia or you may land in Maryland, but you're going to be competing for a lot of people. And those people that actually take the trek all the way to California, to the West Coast and so forth, where, you know, there'll probably be a shortage for people with your skills, your bureaucratic skills or whatever, right? And so what you can offer, I honestly think that they'll probably get a better salary there because it's supply and demand. If they need a bunch of transportation people on the West Coast, then they're going to start paying for people to move out there.
Yes.
And all these people that bailed and filled the jobs on the West Coast at low pay, or the East Coast, I mean, in Virginia and in the surrounding area first, and then the rest of the East Coast, and then start moving a little bit west. You know, those are the people that jump off first. The people that jump off last, they're going to land in much better places and better jobs because they're realizing that the states are going to have to pick this stuff up. And they need to start staffing, you know, their own little Department of Transportation.
Right.
So, now, here's the problem. But here's the little problem that has to happen. Every state has failed to actually amend their constitution every time the federal government came along and said, we need you to create an interface, an office to interface with the Department of Transportation. Go look in the Wyoming Constitution for the government and the state to actually, you know, give them the power, formally giving them the power to create, you know, highways, you know, interstates and, you know, regulating the roads and so forth. There's very few states that have done the due. It's like labor. When the Department of Labor goes away, do we still want to have labor standards? Well, maybe so. But this, again, this is where the states will go, you know, maybe we don't need such rigid labor standards. Maybe we don't have to have, you know, all of these rules that they're throwing at us. And this is where all of a sudden common sense maybe come in. But nevertheless, as we, you know, we look at, you know, the problem, each of the states will actually have to amend their constitution to say, you know, we want the state to do this, or do we? Because the question is, where would that type of government be best? And my advice to everybody, because I'm just, you know, I'm opening up the curtain. You can see the guy over there, and it looks like me, but it's not. Anyway, I'm really on tonight. And yes, folks, we're actually recording it tonight. But anyway, you see that guy over there. Looks a lot like me, but it's not. And, you know, he's kind of telling you that, you know, the government design in this republic is centripetal, or actually centrifugal. Centripetal is where everything is pulled into the center. And the way our government is currently operating is centripetal, because the federal government is pulling in all power and authority to D.C., and they're making every decision of how many watts your light bulb can burn, how many gallons or ounces of water your toilet can flush. In other words, they make every decision. Now, that's not the design. And Thomas Jefferson said that the design of this nation was outward flowing, where the decisions of the people would be made closest to and by the people. So does that mean the state? So no. So my advice, you know, as I've parted the curtain here for that other guy. Oops, sorry, knocked something over. So I parted the curtain so you could see this other guy. And the advice that we have is that you make your state government a general government and limit it to those things that would be necessary for them to support you at the county. Now, technically, that would mean infrastructure. That would mean, you know, communications, that would mean roads, highways, bridges, and so forth. But the beautiful thing about this, if you really look at the republic, I'll just say most of the costs are the interstate highways and the intrastate highways. In other words, the highways that move the bulk of the commerce in and out of the big cities and to all the other cities and towns. Within the cities, within the counties, the inter-county or intra-county roadways would become a county responsibility. In other words, we want the counties to pick up these responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And so that way the state only does, you know, those, the key things. And we're running out of time, so we're going to be going into a break in just a minute. But we want the state to be more general instead of specific and powerful, because if you limit them, then it keeps them from getting out of the bag, because after over the 200 and some odd years, 200, almost 30 years of this federal government, 240 years maybe, they have really proven that you do not want to create the conditions of have a centralized government. And so with that, we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me see if I can keep the momentum going. But bottom line, when we actually start looking at what's going to leave D.C., almost everything, because do we really want the federal government to control our airspaces? No, we want the states to. Why? Because the states do have the responsibilities of managing the domestic matters and affairs. Now, this kind of, remember, we peaked, we created this opening in the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest, there is a need for the Constitution. Now that government has grown to a point where we do need government to do very efficient management, like keeping the planes from flying into each other, I think that's not a good thing. And so we do need to have a centralized air control system where it is kind of centrally managed and so forth. But we do not want the federal government to maintain and manage that. Now, we want them to maintain and manage the external system. Anything that's flying into our airspace, they have that responsibility. But anything that is within our airspace that, you know, takes off and lands, then that should be handled by the domestic, you know, aviation control, DAC, right? Or domestic aviation and avionics or whatever, FAA, you know, it all changes from an F to a D. And so that way we actually have the states managing that. And I'll bet you they will do a much better job. And as a matter of fact, if we maintain this in a way where infrastructure becomes its own little thing, in other words, you create a Congress, or because you don't want to create a single body that manages everything, because it's only proven that when you allow Congress and the courts and everybody to start colluding, it becomes a real problem. And so it's always better, you know, there was this old book, Cheaper by the Dozen.
Mm-hmm.
It's always better if you don't put all of your eggs in one basket like D.C. I mean, how vulnerable is this nation when we had everything in D.C.?
And how do you think that each state should be in control of the airspace?
So each state should have its own control, and actually every airport has its own aircraft control, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, that doesn't change. But we have to have some national location for a small committee to manage the strategies of how and, you know, the ways to interface and work so that we can tell the federal government how to support us.
Mm-hmm.
Because we should be driving the train, not them. Because once we amend the Constitution to allow the states to create these kinds of compacts where we can manage the domestic affairs within the union together, collectively, with, you know, this equal suffrage, kind of like having a Senate for each of these different bodies.
Well, my father worked for the FAA.
Yeah.
Almost his whole life. And
Okay.
He most of the time chose not to fly.
Yeah, but okay, so
he happens to be under this little umbrella we're talking about. But the fact is, most all of that work still needs to be done, but a lot of the manipulation and the maniacal work that has been done by the federal government goes away.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the beautiful thing. If we keep everything in D.C., then the rats and the parasites and all of those, you know, lobbyists that, you know, and influencers that have no reason to be there because they have no right of representation from every member of Congress, right? I mean, if you have a U.S. citizen that's living in D.C. that actually hails from, you know, South Dakota, or maybe hails from Washington State because they're a Forest Service lobbyist, and so they're going and they're talking to every member of Congress. That shouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
That should not be happening. We have a Republican form of government, folks. We don't have a lobbyist form of government. So, in other words, the lobbyists, they don't have right to your representation. That the right to the representation, and only to those things that they have the power to, right? I mean, so when you go talk to your representative in the House of Representatives, the only thing you should actually be talking to them about is why are you operating a draft? You have no authority to do that. I mean, it kind of falls under the umbrella, but that's really a state responsibility. And that's one of the few things that, you know, they would actually keep with the war powers and those types of things, because everything else is going. Everything else has to go. So the lobbyists and everybody else, where are they going to go? And this is the beautiful thing. At least I'm not the king, and I don't want to run anything. But I would say that we would want to maybe put the infrastructure functions, and you want to probably break them up. You know, infrastructure functions of, you know, airwaves and, you know, airplanes and that type of stuff, so like TVs, communications, you know, the air stuff, signals, and things that fly. You know, put that in its own little space and put it in Denver. Or, you know, somewhere in Colorado or Wyoming, right? The top of the nation, right there by the mountains, you know. And then you'd put the roadways and the infrastructures maybe over in Kentucky or Tennessee. And the internet and telephones and energy and those types of things where we got sparks going through wires, maybe we put that somewhere else. So instead of having everything centrally located so the lobbyists can literally walk from one door to the next door to the next door to the next door, if they want to deal with infrastructure and they maybe only focus with electricity, then they're only going to go to that town and try to deal with those folks. But as far as I'm concerned, those doors should not bend. Those doors should not open to corporate lobbyists. They should only be responsible to the states. In other words, absolutely. This is like the Senate. These would function like the Senate, not the House of Representatives. Does that make sense? And so your House of Representatives would be driving, you know, the wants and needs. So who would you actually see when it comes to, you know, are you kidding me? Why are we driving 55? You know, we should be able to drive 120 on these freeways. And the person you need to talk to is your representative at the state level. And they're the ones that need to make this an issue to bring up to this Senate body that is managing the infrastructure. But when it comes down to the roads in your state, it's your representatives. The infrastructure for the national standards, maybe they shouldn't control the road systems. Hey, that's a good idea. Instead of having a national standard of 55 or 65 or 70, let the states do it. And let everybody realize what states are basically straddling the productivity when they say, you can't go over 50. We don't want anybody to be too productive. It's almost like union, right?
Yeah.
I'm creating a lot of hate today. So anyway, the point is that when we're looking at the Ninth Amendment and the rights and privileges and immunities where the government can't be making these regulations – You know, we're actually talking about highways. We're talking about airways and all these things. They don't even have the right to regulate those things. They just assumed it and took it upon themselves. And the state said, yeah, that's a great job. But it's really not, because they've been using it against us. And they're creating all these so they create all these traffic calming to take away your productivity. They've got states installing and actually taking lanes away in cities and in the city streets and so forth, so that it bottlenecks you, so that you have actually have one lane in each direction instead of four or two in each direction. Does that make sense? How many roundabouts have shown up in Wyoming?
I'm not sure. I don't know of any.
You don't know of any, because roundabouts are already in Idaho. They're all over the place in Washington, California. They're showing up everywhere. And folks, all you need to do is Google the Department of Transportation and roundabouts, or actually just Google or do a search for traffic calming, and you'll find that a roundabout is one of the tools that they use to help traffic calm. Why? Because it is a permanent structure that forces you to deviate your trajectory. In other words, if they put a light up, they can actually allow that light to turn off in the middle of the night when they don't need to regulate traffic. Right? Or they have it blinking all red and then green, the main thoroughfare, like it used to be for years ago, you know, because this was a thoroughfare and you had to stop and you had to make sure it was safe to turn. Look at the money. And actually, there's another reason for that. What if you had to get out because all of a sudden, you know, there's a tornado or something else? It restricts your ability to panic and leave. It creates a mess. And so why is it the government is actually trying to make sure you can't escape and that you can't be productive?
Yeah, why?
Well, it is an indictment that our government has become anti-productivity and anti, you know, freedom. It's about control and ensuring that you can't just get away. It's about control.
I never thought of a roundabout that way.
But I mean, so a roundabout, even though it may function and you may like it, it forces you in the middle of the night. If you've ever had to drive through a roundabout in the middle of the night, you just go, why is this thing here? Especially if that's when you travel to work or go home. You know, in non-traffic hours, you go, why? What? This forces me to slow down every day. It's not an efficient use of transportation and energy. It is a permanent, what do you want to call that? A governor, a permanent restriction on the flow of traffic. So, anyway, the point is that when we look at whether they have these powers or not, which they don't, why is it that they're manipulating down to these levels? Because they've assumed power they shouldn't have. This is why we don't want this.
We're letting them.
Well, yes, this is why we don't want them to have this at that level anymore. And nor do we think it would be good necessarily for the state as much. Really, when you start looking at it, and when I get the final article done, I will lay out that the citizens actually need to be involved in county committees and or district committees that I mean, if you live in the city of L.A., where there's 13 million people in that area, maybe a lot less now, or, you know, they're not counting because there's no U.S. citizens left. I don't know. But when you live in a very populated area, then there is absolutely no way you can, you know, not have some form, or you have to have some responsibility of involvement in your government. In other words, if you keep hiring mercenaries to be your governors, then you will always have tyrants looking to kill you. We have a self-governing system. So when you look at the county level, if it's not a heavily populated like LA, then everything would be right there at the county level where you'd have these committees, you know, an infrastructure committee, a commerce committee, you know, controlling and making sure that we bring in the right businesses, you know, that we can actually, because if you control it at the county, you can actually say, I'm sorry, that kind of business, you know, a strip joint or, you know, a topless or adult entertainment, those types of things. That's not going to happen in this county because it's no longer controlled by the state. Don't give the state that authority. It's like, why would we give the state the control over the churches when we should actually do that at the county level? Now, you may live in a county that is literally, you know, just one faith. And why not allow those people to manage their own welfare system and everything else through their faith instead of having the state government do it or the county government do it?
Yeah.
Would all of the Lutherans that are occupying an entire county, would they feel cited? It kind of makes me think about in the old days when Utah was all Mormon, right? And so why would, you know, it be a bad thing if the Mormons took care of the Mormons? Why is that bad? Isn't that how it's supposed to be anyway?
That's a good point.
You take care of your own family. Now, I can understand when you actually have a situation where you have multiple faiths, then we need to come up with a way of, you know, helping promote compassionate services for the different faiths and maybe create a competition between the faiths to find out who's the most compassionate. Maybe what would happen is when people look at where the best compassionate services are, they may find that that's probably where, you know, Christ is living more, or, you know, they find the Spirit there more, you know, because those people are getting it, because that is kind of the pure part of Christianity, is taking, loving one another and taking care of each other. Anyway, my point is that you want these things at the county level. Now, if you have a heavily populated, I'll wrap it up with this. When you have a heavily populated county, you need to subdivide that county into districts, you know, to where when you have that many people, you maybe need to have, you know, these boards and or you distribute, you know, people so that, you know, you have, you know, quadrants of the county that are doing certain functions. And, you know, it can all be done virtually, but there's a way of breaking it down. You have to do that. It's just not reasonable to have, you know, a forum for managing the county infrastructure with 17,000 people that are managers,
yeah,
you know, or strategists that are choosing what would be best. You know, the less cooks you have in the kitchen, probably the better off you are. So you don't want to have too many, but you don't want to have too few either. And you want to make sure that you have enough oversight and other people being involved, which is why you kind of want to have a select people that are kind of making the decisions, but their decisions are based on the guidance coming from the next level down.
And if you use the example of Moses.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's exactly what was on the seal of America. The seal of the United States had Moses leading the 12 tribes out of Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
That was on one side of the seal, and on the other side of the seal, I forget what it was, the two brothers, the Anglo-Saxon brothers.
Yeah, I mean, he had everything divided into.
Right. And so, because Moses actually broke it down to small communities and then larger communities and then larger and eventually up to him. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but that's how, when we look at the schools, does the school need to be managed in D.C. in the swamp? I don't think we're getting a good education from the swamp, and it really seems swampy now.
Yeah.
It really seems indicative of a swamp. So, I'm just trying to give you this view. When we look at the Ninth Amendment, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights, that you have a right to believe and actually proselyte, for the concept of creation. And when you're told that you have to be taught and you have to test and answer the curriculum and work in a curriculum that makes you acknowledge evolution, then that right there must be construed that you are being denied rights that you retain.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. The Ninth Amendment is literally that catch-all. So, anyway, now that we've got the Ninth Amendment, now we want to look at the Tenth. And as a matter of fact, the Tenth Amendment was like the obvious, you know, the guy that always states the obvious, you know, like he walks into the room and everybody's, you know, in a card game and playing poker, what have you. And, you know, he says, hey, what you
powers
doing?
Powers for dummies.
Yeah, well, it's the guy walks in the room and says, what you doing, playing cards? You know, all he's doing is stating the obvious. And, you know, you walk in and see everybody's watching TV and saying, hey, what you doing? You watching TV? Mm-hmm. Why ask the question? So when we read the 10th Amendment, this line was in the Articles of Confederation. Now, there was a change to it, a style change, but it basically said the same thing. And as a matter of fact, in the ratification debates, in many of the states that vigorously debated it, they all brought this up. Hey, what happened to this one line? Go ahead and read the 10th Amendment. Most people will know this, and if you make a mistake, they will probably, you know, call for your head. You know, they're going to be pretty upset because they know this word by word. But go ahead.
The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
You got it right. Excellent job. And so, why did they not include this? And the Constitution was constantly being justified that if the power hasn't been given, then they can't meddle with it. So why do you have to worry about things that aren't delegated? The real problem and the whole point that the Constitution was ratified, it was ratified over this point, that it did not need a Bill of Rights. In other words, Madison, throughout the ratification debate, said we don't need a Bill of Rights. And Virginia accepted that, and they ratified it. And then North Carolina, same. They were one of the last ones to ratify. It was them and Rhode Island that sat out the very first year of the first session. They ratified afterwards and came in the second session, but still, late in the second session. But anyway, what is so important about this is the fact that when we created state constitutions, the county governments didn't put this in the state constitution. Now, I'm saying this because every state knew that in the Articles of Confederation, this line existed, and they recognized that it provided them this safety with this declaration that things are not delegated or restricted from them, period.
Mm-hmm.
So
doesn't the 14th Amendment kind of cover that, though?
So the 14th Amendment only covers the Bill of Rights to the states. And so this goes to this, what I was saying, the federal government really didn't need the Bill of Rights. For the most part, it didn't need the Bill of Rights. It needed, for everything to go sideways, it needed corrupt states to allow and to actually encourage and work with corrupting the federal government. And whether you look at, you know, Hamilton being the first, you know, Hamilton really wasn't the first corrupt politician in government in America. He was the first one in the federal government, and he was a big one. And he was, he made huge impacts, and he made large breaches in that Constitution with the Assumption Act, the Bank Act, and so forth. So when we look at the state constitutions as they were being made up in all of these new states, I'm just absolutely surprised that the people of the county that went into these really had this blind trust. Actually, I think that there was just this, there was this naiveness because so many people were not as literate. When you read the ratification debates, you hear these men citing Montesquieu and Vital and all of these other, you know, telling ancient stories, Cicero. And so you go, wow, I mean, these guys were really literate. They were talking about the historical trappings of this type of government or that type of government.
Yeah.
And so that, I've not looked at, I do have a copy of the Wyoming Constitutional Debates, the journal on the Wyoming Constitution. I have a copy of that. And I'll bet you anything that probably wasn't deep in theory. As a matter of fact, I think that the states kind of looked and go, well, you know, we want to kind of frame it this way. And for the most part, they kind of fell backwards into a decent constitution where they kind of limited the government, but they didn't create this reservation for the counties and the people, like the 10th Amendment. And so when everybody says, oh, well, it's all left to the states. Well, actually, at the federal level, it's left to the states. But at the state level, it should be left to the counties and the people.
Right.
Right. So we kind of see how, you know, we had faith the government would stay contained, that it wouldn't get out of this little boggle, you know, this little thing in there. Don't worry, I'm okay. Just leave me in here. But eventually somebody let that genie out. You know, Hamilton let it out and got it back in, whatever. I mean, actually, he didn't get it back in. But nevertheless, you know, it was just a series of letting out a little bit more of the genie, a little bit more of the genie, or it's like the camel getting into the tent. It's an incremental process, and eventually they get to a point where they're so empowered, they hoodwink you and say, yeah, we can do this. Watch. And they'll lift up their guns. They'll go down the road and scare everybody. And then they'll come back and say, look at what we brought back. It doesn't matter how they do it. They're doing it without the authority. Even when it's, you know, saving the children, as nice as that is, as Washington warned us, that is how good governments are destroyed, is through what is perceived by good intentions. When we allow them to do those things, that over time, they instantly start practicing what I will just say, the exertion of evil powers and controlling powers to control you a little bit more and a little bit more. And that's what we have when we have mercenary law enforcement. And because it becomes the instant argument that you got to give up your guns because they're there to protect you. And, you know, they'll be there as soon as you need them, which is, it's a fallacy. We have a system that we're supposed to protect ourselves and we're supposed to enforce the laws instead of having mercenaries. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.